Chapter 7. Mr. Gray underwent the operation with the utmost fortitude. Physically, he had no choice, since he was immovably attached to the dreadful chair, his legs wide apart and his bare belly open to the knife. The fortitude was on another plane altogether, and although Stephen had cut many and many a patient in the sense of sufferer, he had never known anything to equal Gray's steady voice, nor his perfectly coherent thanks when they cast off the leather-covered chains and his shockingly marked pale glistening face sank back at last. The loss of any patient grieved Stephen professionally, and often personally, and for a long time. He did not think he should lose Gray, although indeed the case had been almost desperate, but a sullen deep infection slowly gained in spite of all that Dr. Maturin could do, and they buried him in 2,000 fathoms, some time before the squadron picked up the northeast trades. The wind, though steady, blew gently at first, and the Commodore had an excellent proof of his ship's sailing qualities. When they were making their best way consonant with keeping station, the Bellona could give the stately royals and lower stunsails. The Aurora could outsail both two-deckers, but the Thames could only just keep up. It did not seem to Jack the fault of her hull, nor a want of activity when the hands raced aloft to loose sail, but rather the absence of anyone in authority who understood the finer points of sailing. Sheets hauled aft by main force, the tack hard down, and bowlines fiddle-string taut whenever the breeze came a little forward of the beam was their universal maxim, though they still outshone all the rest in the matter of gleaming brass and paint. And it had to be admitted that they now fired their guns a little quicker, if not much more accurately. The smaller ships, Smith's 20-gun Camilla and Dick Richardson's 22-gun Laurel, were his delight, however. They were both excellently well handled, and they both had many of the virtues of the dear Surprise, being good sea-boats, very weatherly, and almost as devoid of leeway as a square-rigged ship could possibly be.
"I will tell you what it is, Stephen," said Jack, and they, standing in the stern gallery, surrounded by gilt figures of a former age, the age of long waistcoats, "the glass has shot up in a very whimsical fashion, and in these waters I have never known that happen without there followed a clock calm, or something close to it. In the last dog-watch—" "Oh, Stephen, whenever I say that, I remember your exquisitely beautiful explanation, that the short watch was so called because it was curtailed. Curtailed! So dog! Oh, ha, 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 ha! And I often laugh aloud. Well, if my calculations and Tom's and the master's are right, we should then cut the 31st parallel, and I must open my sealed orders. Our noon observation was so close that I really could have done so then, but I have a superstitious reverence for such things. How I hope there will be good news in them. Orders to seek out the enemy, something like real wartime sailoring. With a squadron this size it would not be unusual, rather than skirmishing about for a parcel of miserable slavers."
"Perhaps the miserable slaves may be worthy of consideration too," observed Stephen.
"Oh, certainly, and I should very much dislike being a slave myself, but Nelson did say that if you abolished the trade—"
He broke off, saying, "However," for this is one of the few points on which they wholly disagreed,
"do you think, Stephen," he went on after a moment, during which the Ringle shot across their wake,
she, being the Bellona's tender, was not required to keep to any particular station, so long as she was always within hail, and Reed made the most of her delightful powers,
"do not think that I am murmuring, or discontented, or ungrateful for having this splendid command, but I have thought, and reflected, and pondered—"
"Brother," said Stephen, "you grow prolix."
"And I believe it is too splendid for the work it is given. Besides, there are several things I have disliked about it almost from the beginning. It was booted abroad like any football, and the newspapers had pieces like, 'We learn from a gentleman very close to the ministry that extremely strong measures against the odious traffic in negroes have been decided to be made, and the gallant Captain Aubrey, determined that freedom shall reign by sea as well as by land, has sailed with a powerful squadron.' And the wretch names them all with compliment and number of guns. And that paper, with the Post and the Courier, also point out very truly that this was the first time line of battleships had ever been sent on such a mission. 'A very great effort to stamp out this vile commerce in human flesh was to be made, which redounded much to the something of the ministry.' I read that in Lisbon, and then there were dozens more of the same kind. There has been a great deal of fuss and unnecessary talk, often very personal and unpleasant. Flashy. How can we be expected to take them by surprise if it is shouted from the housetops? but what I really meant to say was that, whether there is good news or no, I am sure, as you can be of anything at sea, that there will be little wind or none at all, and I mean to ask the post-captains to dinner. You cannot have an even half-efficient squadron without there is reasonable good understanding."
"If you wish to reach a good understanding with the Purple Emperor, you have but to tell him of Lord Nelson, slavery, and the Royal Navy. His surgeon consulted me about the Imperial health. I went across to look at the patient, and he gave me his views on our mission. It was the greatest nonsense to try to guard a great stretch of coast from north to south with a squadron of our size. And even if we were confined to the general area of Wider, for example, no ship of the line and very few frigates could catch a slaver, except in very heavy weather. They were nearly all long, low schooners, very weatherly, built above all for speed and handled by capital seamen. But even if that was not the case, what would be the point? The poor creatures, coming from all sorts of tribes in the interior, with no common language between them and often deadly hatred, were, upon being rescued, put down in Sierra Leone or some other crowded, well-meaning place and told to till a plot, people who had never tilled anything in their lives and who ate different kinds of food. No, no. It was far better, far kinder, to let them take the rapid and easy middle passage, be landed quickly in the West Indies and sold to men who would not only look after them, anyone with any sense of his own interest takes care of what has cost him dear, but who might also make Christians of them, which was the kindest thing of all, since the slaves would be saved, while all those left in Africa, or taken back to Africa, must necessarily be damned. He then repeated your piece about the abolition of the slave trade being the destruction of the navy, and ended by saying that slavery was approved in holy writ. He was, however, firmly determined to carry out his orders to the very best of his ability, that being the duty of an officer."
"What did you say to that, Stephen?"
"Faith, I said nothing. There were few intervals into which I could have slipped a word, but from time to time I made a non-committal movement of my head. Then I prescribed him a dose that may have a mollifying effect. It will certainly purge his more malignant humours."
"Perhaps he will be better company. It must be a weary life, being in a permanent state of rage, or at least at half-cock."
Jack's ear caught the little ping of the chiming and repeating watch in Stephen's pocket.
"The last dog!"
he cried, and walking into the cabin, he rang for a midshipman.
"Mr. Weatherby," he said, "be so good as to carry my compliments to Captain Pullings, and say that I should like to know the distance made good since the noon observation."
"Aye, aye, sir," said the young gentleman.
And he came back in under a minute with a slip of paper. Jack looked at it, smiled, stepped into the master's day cabin for a last check, and hurried to the iron box in his locker. Pierced iron, weighted with lead, for documents that must not be taken, that must sink on being thrown overboard, sink at once beyond recovery. Signals, codes, official letters. His secret orders were the most voluminous he had ever received, and he saw with keen pleasure that they included the remarks and observations of those commanders who had preceded him since 1808 with the same missions, for his own acquaintance with the coast was almost entirely confided to sailing past it as far off and as quickly as possible. An extraordinarily unhealthy part of the world, and close in with variable winds or calms and distressing currents. But when he had turned them over, he ran his eye down the orders themselves, and halfway along his face glowed bright with pleasure. With extreme rapidity his glance seized the fact that, having harassed the slavers, he was at a certain date and in a given longitude and latitude to assemble the ships named in the margin and steer an appropriate course to intercept and destroy a French squadron that would sail from Brest at a given date, at first heading for the Azores and then in or about 25 degrees of west longitude, changing course for Bantry Bay. All this was accompanied by a mass of qualifications, but Jack was used to them. He had grasped the essence in a moment, and his eyes ran down to the paragraph that had ended so many of his orders, that in this undertaking he was to consult and advise with Dr. Stephen Maturin, through whom more precise dates and positions might later be conveyed through suitable channels, on all points that might have a political or diplomatic significance. Disregarding the assurance, their lordship's graceful finishing touch, that he must not fail in this or any part of it, as he would answer the contrary at his peril, he called Stephen in from the great stern gallery, the most engaging piece of naval architecture known to man, in fact. But hardly had the doctor turned before the radiance in Jack's face, smile, eyes, dropped by 2 or 3 powers. The French clearly intended another invasion of Ireland, or liberation, as they put it, and he felt a little shy of broaching the matter.
Stephen had never made his views vehemently, injuriously clear, but Jack knew very well that he preferred the English to stay in England and to leave the government of Ireland to the Irish. Stephen saw the change in his face, a large, essentially red face, in spite of the tan in which his blue eyes shone with an uncommon brilliance, a face made for good humour, and the papers in his hand.
"You know all about this, I'm sure, Stephen."
Stephen nodded.
"Anyhow, there is a paper for you," holding it out. "Shall we take a turn on the poop?"
Privacy, even for a commodore of the first class, with a post captain under him and a rear admiral's hat, was a rare bird in the man of war, that intensely curious and gossiping community. Above all, in a man of war with such more than usually inquisitive hands as Killick and his mate Grimble, whose duties took them into holy places, and who were extraordinarily knowing about which grating on which deck and with which wind was likely to carry voices best. The poop, a fine lordly sweep of about 50 feet by 28, was soon cleared of the signal yeoman and his friends, and Jack and Stephen paced the deck athwartships for a while.
"You are puzzled to know how to begin, my dear," said Stephen, after half a dozen turns. "So I will tell you how it is. The Irish question, as people are coming to call it in the newspapers, can, as I see it, be solved by two simple measures, Catholic emancipation and the dissolution of the Union. And it is possible, possible, that this may come about in time without violence. But were the French to be there and busily arming the discontented, there would be the very devil to pay, endless violence, and it might even tip the balance, giving that infernal Bonaparte the victory. And where would Ireland be then? In a very much worse state, under an efficient and totally unscrupulous tyranny, Catholic only in name, and remarkably avid for spoil. Think of Rome, Venice, Switzerland, Malta. No. Though it would grieve many of my friends, I should with all my heart prevent a French landing. I have served long enough in the Navy to prefer the lesser of two weevils."
"So you have, brother," said Jack, looking at him affectionately. "I am, of course, required and directed to advise with you on difficult points, and I shall show you the whole set of papers presently, when you are at leisure. Though in passing, let me say that the Admiralty, having observed that the loss of men from disease was sometimes very great on the West African coast, said that in the early period a severely sick or diseased ship might collect a judicious number of invalids from other vessels and stretch away to Ascension Island, where refreshments were to be had in the form of turtles in the proper season, clear fresh water, and certain green plants."
"Ah, Ascension," said Stephen in a voice of longing.
"And they say that the present governor of Sierra Leone is my old shipmate James Wood. You remember James Wood, Stephen? He was shot through the throat at Porto Vecchio, and talks in a wheeze. We went aboard him in the Downs when he had the Hebe, and he came to stay at Ashgrove."
"The cheerful gentleman who filled his ship with such unconscionable amounts of rope and paint and the like?"
"Just so. No stickler for form. He loved to go to sea in a well-found ship, even if it meant conciliating the dockyard people to a surprising degree. And an uncommon keen hand at whist."
"I remember him perfectly."
"Of course you do," said Jack,
smiling at the recollection of Captain Wood's jovial way with a bribe, his acquisition of one of the flagship's spare anchors.
"And since you know everything about the second part," he continued in little more than a whisper, "I shan't go on about it at all. Not a word. Tace is the Latin for a candlestick. But I will tell you about the first, about knocking the slavers on the head. We are required to make a great roaring din straight away and amaze all observers, as well as liberating as many slaves as possible. Now, I have no experience of this particular service at all, and although I have glanced at the earlier commander's tolerably meagre remarks, I should still like to know a great deal more, and I believe asking questions is the only way of finding out. You cannot ask questions of a book or a report, but a word to the cove that wrote it would make everything clear. So I mean to summon all captains and ask them what they know, and then I shall invite them to dinner tomorrow."
He strode forward and called down the quarter-deck.
"Captain Pullings!"
"Sir, let us heave out the signal for all captains."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Mr. Miller,"
to the officer of the watch.
"All captains."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Mr. Soames."
And so it went from signal lieutenant to the signal midshipman, and thus to the yeoman of the signals himself, who had had plenty of time to prepare the hoist, "All captains repair aboard pennant," that broke out at the Bellona's masthead a moment later, to be echoed along the line by the repeating brigs and to spread consternation in many a cabin, where captains flung off their duck trousers and nankeen jackets. It was a hot day with the breeze aft, and struggled, sweating, into white stockings, white breeches, and white waistcoat, the whole topped with a blue broadcloth gold-laced coat. They arrived in no particular order, but in excellent time, only the Thames barge being somewhat late. Her captain could be heard cursing his midshipman, his coxswain, and "that son of a bitch at bow-oar!" for the best part of 5 minutes. When they were all assembled on the poop, which seemed to Jack an airier, more informal place than the quarter-deck, he said to them,
"Gentlemen, I must tell you that my orders require the squadron to make a very strong demonstration of force at our first arrival on the coast. I have the remarks and observations of earlier commodores on the station, but I should also like to question officers who have been on this service. Have any of you been engaged, or any of your officers?"
A general murmur, a looking at one another, and Jack, turning to Captain Thomas, who had long served in the West Indies and who owned property there, asked him whether he had anything particular to say.
"Why me?" cried Thomas. "Why should I have anything particular to say about slavery?"
Then, seeing the astonishment on the faces all round him, he checked himself, coughed, and went on,
"I ask pardon, sir, if I have spoken a little abruptly. I was put out by my bargeman's stupidity. No, I have nothing particular to say."
Here he checked again, and Stephen and Mr. Adams' eyes met in a fleeting glance, the expression of neither altered in the least degree, but each was certain that the swallowed words were a eulogy of the trade and indeed of slavery itself.
"Well, I'm sorry to have drawn a blank covert," said Jack, looking round his captain's uniform stupidity, "but my predecessor's reports make it perfectly clear that much of this service is inshore, small craft work, and I must desire all officers present to ensure that their boats are in very good order, with their crews thoroughly accustomed to stepping masts and proceeding under sail for considerable distances. Mr. Howard, I believe I saw you lower down your launch in a most surprising brisk manner the day before yesterday."
Yes, sir," said Howard laughingly. "It was the usual idiot ship's boy. He harpooned a bonito with such zeal that he flung himself out of the bridle port on to the fish, the harpoon fast to his wrist. Fortunately, the launch was in the act of being shifted, so we got her over the side straight away and saved our only decent weapon."
"Well done," said Jack. "Well done indeed. And the word weapon reminds me. Getting boats over the side quick and handling them well is very important, but it must not affect our great gun exercises, which, as you will all admit, still leave something to be desired. Yet tomorrow is a somewhat exceptional day, and tomorrow I hope and trust the exercise will leave you all time enough to dine with me."
Two bells, and Killick, his mate, and three mess attendants walked carefully up the poop ladder, the first two carrying trays with decanters of all things proper to be drunk at such an hour, the others with glasses to drink them from. As the captains were being piped over the side, Stephen's friend Howard came and, standing by him, said discreetly,
"Of course, Maturin, you know the Commodore infinitely better than I do. Is he very exact and naval in his use of the word officer?"
"Fairly so, I believe.
Certainly punctilious in the use of rank and title. He could no more bear the Swedish knight than could Nelson, but he is the most reasonable of men."
"To be sure. I was astonished at the cogency, sequence, and clarity of his account of nutation at the Royal Society. Scholey took me, and for several days I believe I understood not only nutation, but even the precession of the equinoxes."
"Sure, he is the great astronomer of the world."
"Yes, but my point is this. In the Aurora I have an elderly master's mate called Hewell, and a master's mate, as you know very well, is not an officer in our ordinary use of the word, a commission officer. He served his time, passed his public or quasi-public examination for lieutenant, but failed to pass for gentleman. In short, the examining officers, conferring in private, did not think him one, and so no commission was ever made out. Yet he is a good seaman, and he knows a great deal about slave ships and their ways."
"Then I am perfectly certain that the Commodore would like to see him."
"He could hardly ask better. Hewell was born in Jamaica, the son of a shipowner. He first went to sea in one of his father's merchantmen, carrying goods and some slaves, and then Dick Harrison took him into the Euterpe on the quarter-deck. During the peace he served in one of the Thomas's regular slavers as a mate, but he sickened of it and was glad to get back into the service, into John West's Euryalus, and then with me."
"I did not know that Captain Thomas owned slavers."
"It is a family concern, but he is extremely sensitive about it since the law abolished the trade. Don't choose to have it known."
Hewell was aboard within 10 minutes, in spite of having had to shave and change into his best uniform. He was a short, straight, round-headed man of about 35, far from handsome. The smallpox had marked his face terribly, and where it was not pitted by the disease, an exploding 12-pounder cartridge case had covered it with a dense sprinkling of black dots. Furthermore, his teeth were very bad, gapped and discoloured. Yet this positive ugliness did not account for his present position in the Navy, perhaps the most uncomfortable of them all, since, as Jack knew very well, midshipmen worse looking by far had been given a commission on passing for lieutenant at Somerset House. No, the trouble was the yellow tinge in what complexion Hewell could be said to possess, the evident legacy of an African great-grandmother.
"Sit down, Mr. Hewell,"
said Jack, rising as he came into the great cabin.
"You are no doubt aware that our squadron is intended to put down the slave trade, or at least to discourage it as much as possible. I am told that you have a considerable knowledge of the subject. Pray give me a brief account of your experience. And Dr. Maturin here would also like to know something of the matter. Not the nautical side, or the particular winds and the Bight of Benin, you understand, but the more general aspects."
"Well, sir," said Hewell, looking Jack straight in the face while he ordered his thoughts, "I was born in Kingston, where my father owned some merchantmen, and when I was a boy I used often to go alone in one or another of them, trading in the islands, up to the States or across to Africa, to Cape Palmas and right along into the Gulf for palm oil, gold if we could get it, guinea pepper and elephant's teeth, and some negroes if they were offering, but not many since we were not regular slavers, fitted up to deal with them by wholesale. So I came to know those waters, particularly in the Gulf, tolerably well. Then, after some while, my father told his old acquaintance, Captain Harrison, that I was wild to go aboard a man of war, and he very kindly took me onto his quarter-deck in Euterpe, lying in Kingston at the time. I served in her for 3 years, and then followed my captain into the Topaz, where he rated me master's mate. That was just before the peace, when the ship was paid off at Chatham. I made my way back to Jamaica, and took what I could find. My father had left off business by then, mostly small merchantmen to Guinea and south right down to Cabinda or over to Brazil, a few negroes as before. But although I was thoroughly used to slavers and their ways, particularly the big Liverpool ships, I never sailed in one until I went aboard the Elkins in Montego Bay. And then, although the owners had made out she carried mixed cargoes, I saw she was a high flyer in that line the moment I set foot on deck."
"How could you tell that, sir?" asked Stephen.
"Why, sir, her galley overflowed in every direction. Ordinarily a ship has coppers enough to cook for the crew, in this case, say, 30 hands, but here they were calculated for keeping 400 or 500 slaves alive for the 4,000 or 5,000 miles of the Middle Passage, say a couple of months, and her water was in proportion. Then again she had a slave deck, which was perfect proof."
"I do not think I know the term."
"Well, it is not a deck at all, in the sense of planking, but rather a set of gratings covering the whole space set aside for the slaves and letting air into it. And about 2 or 2.5 feet under these gratings they sit, or squat, usually in rows running athwartships, the men forward, chained in pairs, and the women aft."
"Even in 2.5 feet they could barely sit upright, let alone stand."
"No, sir, and it is often less."
"How many might there be at all?"
"Broadly speaking, as many as they can cram in. The usual reckoning is 3 for every ton the ship gauges. So the Elkins, that I was in, could stow 500, she being 170 ton, and that may answer for a quick passage. But there are some that force them in so tight that if one man moves, all must move, and then, unless there are leading winds most of the way, the result is terrible."
"When are they let out?"
"Never at all when they are within swimming distance of the land. At sea, by groups in the daytime."
"What of cleanliness by night?"
"There is none, sir, none whatsoever. Some ships turn a hose on the filth and man the pumps in the forenoon watch, and some make the negroes clean up and then wash on deck. They are all stark naked, with vinegar in the water. But even so, a slaver stinks a mile and more to leeward."
"Surely," said Stephen, "with such filth, such crowding in such foul air and this heat, surely disease must ensue."
"Yes, sir, it does. Even if the blacks have not suffered very much when they are captured and then marched down to the coast and kept in the barracoon, and even if they don't have to sit waiting cooped up on the slave deck for a week or so until the cargo is completed, the flux very often starts the 3rd or 4th day, about the time the seasickness stops, and then they generally start dying. Sometimes it seems of mere misery.
even in a reasonably careful ship, where they whipped the slaves that would not eat and made them run about the deck for the air and exercise, I have known 20 a day go over the side, a week out from Whydah. It is not reckoned extraordinary if a third of the cargo is lost.
Do no intelligent masters calculate that a more humane policy might be more profitable? After all, a stout negro fetches from 40 to 60 pounds at the auction block.
There are a few, sir. Men that pride themselves on presenting prime stock, as they put it. Some even have fattening farms with medical care. But most find it don't answer. The profits, even with a third loss, are so great now the trade is illegal that they think it best to cram full every time, whatever the risk. And there is always the chance of a fair wind out of the bight and a quick and healthy run.
What kind of vessels are there at present?
Asked Jack.
Well, sir, after the passing of the Act abolishing the trade and the coming of the preventive squadron, most of these ships gave up. There are a few fast-sailing brigs on the Bahia or Rio voyage from the Bight. I say nothing about the old-fashioned Portuguese south of the line because they are protected, but most of the slavers now are schooners, faster on a wind and more weatherly, from quite small craft up to the new 300-ton Baltimore clippers, sailing under Spanish colours, often false, with a more or less American crew, and a master that says he is a Spaniard, the Spaniards not being subject to our law. But now, since the preventive squadron was withdrawn, some of the old hands have come back, patching up their old ships more or less, and making the Havana run. They usually know the coast very well, and the chiefs, and sometimes they run in where a stranger would not dare to go. Yet the larger craft have to load through the surf by canoes in many places. It is all inshore work on a very low coast all the way down to the Bight of Biafra, mangrove swamps and mud for hundreds of miles, and mosquitoes so thick you can hardly breathe, particularly in the rainy season, though every now and then there are inlets, little gaps in the forest if you know where to look, and that is where the smaller schooners go, sometimes taking a full cargo aboard in a day.
"Do you know the whole of the coast, Mr. Hewell?" asked Jack.
"I should not say. I was a pilot for the country between Cape Lopez and Benguela, sir, but I am pretty well acquainted with the rest."
"Then let us look at this general chart and work down from the north. I should like you to give me a rough idea of local conditions, currents, breezes, of course, active markets, and so on. Then another day with Captain Pullings, the master, and my secretary to take notes, we will go over it all more thoroughly. Now here is Sierra Leone and Freetown. Doctor," he called, "you are very welcome to stay if you choose, but I must warn you that from now on our discussion is likely to be purely nautical. Dull work for a landsman."
"What makes you think that I resemble a landsman, Commodore, I beg? I am salted to the bone, a pickled herring. But, however," looking at his watch, "my sick berth calls me. Good day to you, Mr. Hewell. One day I hope you will have time to tell me a little of the West African mammals. I believe there are no less than 3 species of pangolin."
The next day was that of the Commodore's dinner to his captains, a day rendered wearisome beyond expression for those who lived aft, by the incessant ill-tempered and querulous activity of the Commodore's steward, Preserved Killick, his mate Grimble, the Commodore's and Captain's cooks, and as many hands as they could press into their service to turn out, scrub, swab, polish, replace, and arrange, with a truly forbidding rigour, the whole accompanied by a high-pitched, nagging stream of abuse and complaint that drove Jack onto the quarter-deck, where once again he showed the youngsters the right way of handling a sextant and examined the midshipmen's berth on their knowledge of the chief navigational stars, and Stephen to the orlop, where he read through his assistant's notes until he was interrupted by a ship's boy who told him that the stately surgeon had called to see him. Mr. Gifford and Stephen were fairly well acquainted. Well enough, in any case, for Gifford's initial embarrassment to persuade Stephen that this was not an ordinary visit, nor a request for the loan of a carboy of Venice treacle or 100 weight of portable soup and some lint. And indeed, after a tedious discussion of the trade wind, Gifford asked whether they might talk privately. Stephen led him back to the orlop, to his little cabin, and there Gifford said, "This may be considered a proper subject for 2 medical men, I trust. I think I betray no confidences or offend against professional discretion when I say that our captain is a pederast, that he calls young foremast hands into his cabin by night, and that the officers are much concerned, since these youths are much favoured, which in time will destroy discipline altogether. It is already much loosened that they hesitate to take any official action, which must necessarily result in ignominious hanging and throw great discredit on the ship. They hope that a private word to the Commodore would have the desired effect. A medical man... a friend, and an old shipmate.
His voice died away.
"I will not pretend to misunderstand you," said Stephen, "but I must tell you that I abhor an informer very much more than I abhor a sodomite, if indeed I can be said to abhor a sodomite, qua sodomite at all. One has but to think of Achilles, and hundreds more. It is true that in our society such connections are out of place in a man of war, yet you adduce nothing but probabilities. Is a man's reputation to be blasted on a mere statement of probabilities, and they at second hand?"
"There is the good of the service," said Gifford.
"Very true," said Stephen,
breaking off to call out, "Come in!"
"Please, sir," said a ship's boy, "Mr. Killick says ain't you ever going to come and try your frilled shirt, which he has been standing there with it in his hand this half glass and more."
"Mary and Joseph," cried Stephen, clapping his hand to where his warning watch should have been had he not left it in the quarter gallery.
"Mr. Gifford, sir, I beg you will forgive me. May I wait upon you when I have considered?"
The power of running up a cambric shirt to measure, adorning it with a frilled front, and then ironing that frill to crisp perfection, seemed improbable in so uncouth a creature as Killick. But he was a seaman, and handy with his needle even for a seaman, and neither he nor anyone else thought it out of the way. It was in this elegant shirt, therefore, that Stephen stood on the Bellona's quarter-deck to await the arrival of the guests. Thames, Aurora, Camilla, Laurel, as the captains were called, arrived in close order, to be piped aboard and welcomed. And they were all there when the Stapley's barge appeared, steered by Duff's proud coxswain, with a midshipman in a gold-laced hat beside him, and pulled by 10 young bargemen, tricked out to the height of nautical elegance and splendour. Tight white trousers, with ribbons down the seams, embroidered shirts, crimson neckerchiefs, broad-brimmed sennet hats, gleaming pigtails. With Gifford's words in his mind, Stephen looked at them attentively. Individually, each sailor would have been very well, but since they were all uniformly decorated, he thought it overdone. He was not alone. Jack Aubrey glanced down into the barge after he had received Captain Duff, laughed very heartily, and said,
"Upon my word, Mr. Duff, you'll have to take care of those young ladies' rig, or coarse-minded people will be getting very comical ideas into their heads. They will say, 'Sodom tomorrow,' and quote Article 29.
The dinner itself went well, and even the Purple Emperor, conscious of his gaff and devoted to his belly, laid himself out to be agreeable. Attentive trolling from the wardroom lights had provided a handsome young swordfish, the Commodore's livestock, 3 pair of fowls, and a sheep, his cellar a considerable quantity of claret, unavoidably rather warm, but of a quality to stand it, and the small Jersey cow a syllabub, while there was still some tolerable cheese with almond cakes to go with the full tide of port. Stephen enjoyed himself, sitting next to Howard, with whom he talked of Sappho and the delights of the diving bell, on the one side, and on the other a marine officer who knew a surprising number of people in the literary world of London, and who, to his intense pleasure, told him about a novel by a Mr. John Paulton, that everyone was reading at present with great applause, a novel dedicated, curiously enough, to a gentleman of the same name as Dr. Maturin, a relative, no doubt. Captain Duff sat immediately opposite him, and they exchanged a few amiable words, but the table was too wide and the sound of talk too powerful for more. Yet from time to time, when his neighbours were engaged elsewhere, Stephen considered his face, demeanour, and conversation. Duff was an unusually good-looking, manly fellow of about 35, rather larger than most, with no hint of those traits usually associated with unorthodox affections. He seemed to have been totally unmoved by the Commodore's ribaldry, and at times Stephen wondered whether the Stately's officers were not mistaken. He was obviously a friendly man, as were so many sea officers, willing to please and to be pleased, a good listener, and Stephen knew that he had fought one of his commands, a 32-gun, 12-pounder frigate, with great distinction, yet there were moments when a certain anxiety seemed to appear, a certain desire for approval.
"If his officers are right," reflected Stephen, when they had drunk the loyal toast, "how I hope that Jack's wholly candid and innocent remark will serve as warning enough."
The whole gathering took coffee on the poop, standing about with little cups in their hands and delighting in the breeze. Before taking his leave of the Commodore, Duff came over and said he hoped he might see something of Dr. Maturin ashore when they reached Sierra Leone.
"I hope so too, I do indeed," said Stephen, "and I very much look forward to making acquaintance with the birds, beasts, and flowers. We have a young officer aboard who knows the country well, and I have asked him to tell me about them."
But it was long
long before Mr. Hewell could tell the doctor what he knew about the West African mammals, since day after day he was closeted with the Commodore and his chief officers as the squadron sailed slowly south. Ordinarily, this was the most agreeable part of a voyage in a well-found ship, this rolling down the trades in warm but not yet oppressive sunshine, never touching sheet nor brace, the people making their hot-weather clothes on deck by day and dancing on the forecastle in the evening. But now everything was changed, utterly changed, changed beyond the memory of the oldest hand aboard. The Commodore, well seconded by most of his captains, started working up the squadron.
"There is not a moment to be lost," he observed, having heaved out the Thames's signal to make more sail, and indeed there was not. Even his own ship, though far superior in gunnery with her strong contingent of old surprises, was not nearly as brisk as the Thames in lowering, manning, and arming all boats, and many a harsh word on this subject did Captain Pullings utter to his lieutenants, master's mates, and midshipmen, words that were earnestly passed on, sometimes with an almost excessive warmth. This lowering down of boats at great speed, like the shifting of topgallant masts in 13 minutes 55 seconds, or striking them in 2 minutes 25 seconds, was one of those harbour exercises that commanders on the West Indies station excelled in. And although the Thames's people did not seem to know what to do with their boats once they were in the water, apart from pulling them, their speed vexed the rest of the squadron to the very heart. Day after day they toiled at the great gun exercise, at small arms practice, and at this full-blown boat drill which often included shipping carronades in their larger craft. And all these activities, which could be, and which were, accurately timed, were of course carried out in addition to all ordinary duties. And although they wore the people into something like a state of torpor in the early days, there was a striking drop in the number of defaulters throughout the squadron, even in the Thames, that unhappy ship. Almost no drunkenness, no fighting, and no murmuring, a graver crime than either. Emulation came violently into play from the very beginning, and Stephen once saw his old, mild, fat and bald friend Joe Place fling his hat on the deck, stamping on it with a vile oath, when the blue cutter's midshipman, having worked out the agreed handicap, stated that the Laurel had beaten them by 6 seconds in crossing upper yards. Indeed, Jack Aubrey, who saw the stony looks with which his bargemen were received, sometimes wondered whether the rivalry might not be growing too high altogether. But he had no great time for abstract thought, since he spent the clear of his day with Hewell, John Woodbine, the Bellona's master and an excellent navigator, Mr. Adams, and sometimes Tom Pullings, going over the charts, noting all Hewell's observations, collating them with his Admiralty papers, and trying in his inner mind to work out a brief, initially startling campaign against the slavers, a campaign that would impress public opinion. But brief, brief. It had to be brief. He was obsessed with the dread of missing his appointment with the French, the whole real meaning of the expedition, and he knew, who better, that virtually the whole of the African coast with which he was concerned, particularly the dreaded bights, was unreliable from the point of view of wind. If he were to cut things at all fine, and find the squadron on its way north for the meeting, caught in the doldrums, sails flaccid, no steerage way, while the French were racing northeast towards Ireland from some point near the Azores, for they were to make a feint in that direction, as though they were to attack the West Indies, he would hang himself from the maintop. On the other hand, he must do as much as possible of what he was sent to do, and be seen and heard in the act of doing it. With Gray's death there was a vacancy among the Bellona's lieutenants, and he filled it by giving Hewell an acting order. As he knew it would, this grieved some of his own young men most bitterly, since an acting order given by a commodore was almost invariably converted into a full commission by the Admiralty. But he could not do without Hewell's quite exceptional knowledge and contacts, his understanding of affairs, tribal and mercantile, right down the coast, his languages. Furthermore, even before growing used to Hewell's hideous smile, he had come to like the man, not only for his clear-minded, intelligent accuracy and his officer-like understanding of the sea, but for himself. These planning sessions often overflowed the set mealtimes, and Jack and his colleagues would carry on right through dinner, or even, on occasion, skip the sacred meal itself. This threw Stephen back to his natural place in the ship's economy. The surgeon was a member of the wardroom mess, yet although the Bellona's wardroom was a long, handsome apartment with a noble stern gallery of its own, it was somewhat crowded,
As a pennant ship, she carried an extra lieutenant and an extra marine officer, so that when Stephen appeared, usually rather late, he was the 13th guest, which made his messmates and all the servants most uneasy. Then again, he had so rarely eaten there before that they scarcely knew what to make of him. He was known to be the captain's and the commodore's particular friend, and he was said to be richer than either, a further cause for reserve, all the more so since he possessed little in the way of small talk, and was often absent in spirit. In short, he felt something of a restraint on the gathering, which curiously enough contained not a single one of his old shipmates. And since he also found the roaring mirth and interminable anecdotes of two of the marine lieutenants and the purser's card tricks somewhat oppressive, he took to coming in towards the end of the meal, and either eating a scrap there or taking it away in a napkin to his official surgeon's cabin far below on the orlop. All this time, all this voyage from Corunna, Stephen's entire being had been deeply suffused with happiness, waking and sleeping, a subjacent happiness always ready to become fully conscious. Yet at present it was accompanied rather than tinged with a mild regret for the seafaring life he had known, the life of a village where one knew all the inhabitants and by force of long acquaintance came to like virtually all of them, a village whose geography, though complex, followed a marine logic of its own, and eventually grew as familiar as that of a house. A two-decker, however, was a town, and a very long commission would be needed to create anything like the same interdependence and fellowship among its 600 people, counting supernumeraries, if ever it did so at all. He had known the Worcester, of course, and the horrible old Leopard, but the first was so short and variegated in experience, and the second, little bigger than a heavy frigate, had led to such a wealth of discoveries in natural philosophy among the creatures and the sparse vegetation of the Antarctic, that they scarcely formed the other half of the comparison. "It is not only the vast size that makes the essential difference," he reflected, leaving his cabin to take some air before his rounds, "but the intrusion of another dimension, this additional floor or deck." As the words formed in his mind, and as his feet moved him up the ladder, so his head rose above the floor, or deck, in question, and once again in his sea-going life he was perfectly amazed and rapt in admiration. All the gun-ports were open wide. Brilliant light from the declining sun reflected from the calm, rippling sea flooded the whole vast, clean space, a prevailing tone of light brown subtly varied by the masts, and on either side its exact rows of great 32-pounder guns, while the far end was closed by the canvas screen of his sick berth, the whole in its perfect, ordered simplicity making an enormous still life, as satisfying as he had ever seen. "What kind of an exercise can have brought about this beautiful state of affairs?" he asked. Exercises of every kind were always taking place throughout the squadron, as he knew very well from the casualties brought below, sprains, crushed toes, the usual hernia or so, and powder burns. But what could have caused this splendid, luminous vacancy, smelling of salt and tar and slow match, he could not tell. The still life changed as he contemplated it, changed quite surprisingly with the appearance of a small boy who dropped bodily through a hatchway right forward, and came running aft. "There you are, sir," he cried, perfectly sure of his welcome. "I've been looking for you everywhere. Commodore's compliments, if you please, and shall be happy to see Dr. Maturin on the poop at his leisure." "Thank you, Mr. Weatherby. Pray tell the Commodore, with my respects, that as soon as I have looked into the sick berth, I shall do myself the honour of waiting on him upstairs."
"Why, Stephen, there you are," cried Jack. "I've not seen you this age. How do you do?"
"Admirably well, I thank you. My sick berth gives me great satisfaction. But," he went on, turning Jack to the light and peering up into his face, "I cannot congratulate you on your looks."
"You have never yet congratulated me on my looks at any time. It would make me uneasy if you were to begin now."
"No, but now the sickly pallor of thought to which I am not accustomed is superadded, of thought, study, and watching. Let me see your tongue. Very indifferent. Oh, very indifferent. And an ill breath, too. Fetid. Have you omitted your morning swim, your forenoon climb to the various eminences, your 3-mile pacing before quarters?"
"Yes, I have. The first because of the unreasonable number of sharks. Fuel says they always swarm in slaving waters. And the rest because I have scarcely stirred from the cabin.
I've been working out a plan of campaign with great attention and urgency because, do you see, although I mean to do all that can be reasonably expected in the slavery line, I want to do it quick, leaving all possible time for the rest. You understand me. A pretty set of jack puddings we should look, arriving after the fair.
I do most earnestly hope that you are satisfied with your progress.
Well, Stephen, it sounds boastful, but I must admit I am. With the help of that excellent young man Hewell, Tom and Mr. Woodbine and I have worked out a series of movements that, given moderate luck, should be quite successful. The only thing I very much regret is that I see no possibility whatsoever of making a prodigious great thundering din on our first arrival, as their lordships desire me to do.
Lowering his voice and steering the doctor right aft, so that they stood by one of the splendid great stern lanterns, swaying to the even pitch and roll, he went on,
"It may seem wicked, even blasphemous, to say that my orders might have been written by a parcel of landsmen accustomed to the regularity of travelling by stagecoach or by navigation on an inland canal. Yet, on the other hand, some of the lords are mere land-born politicians. And anyhow, the orders passed down through the secretary, that ass Barrow, to a number of clerks who may never have been afloat at all, but all that to one side. I have received orders that make no account of wind or tide before this, and so have all other sea officers. I do not complain. But what I really cannot understand is that the ministry should expect me to take the slavers by surprise when our expedition has been advertised to the world in half a dozen daily sheets, including the Times. For do not tell me that those paragraphs appeared without Whitehall's knowledge. No, the only thing that I can think of doing is to have a full-blown great-gun exercise as soon as we are lying before the town. At least that will make an infernal uproar. But it is vexing, for Hewell tells me that as soon as the preventive squadron was withdrawn, the trade started again, even in the Gallinas River and on Sherbrooke Island, right next to Freetown, and with a little discretion we might have seized on half a dozen loading slaves in the estuary. However, I shall send the Ringle in tomorrow to have some powder waiting for us. It is only a day's sail for her with this breeze.
May you not be doing the ministry an injustice, my dear? Conceivably, they reflected that whereas the French intelligence people are among the most attentive readers of the Times and the Post, few slavers in the Bight of Benin subscribe to either, and that the French, convinced that you are busy south of the tropic line, a conviction reinforced by reports of the noise in question, will carry on with their knavish tricks, their plans, in spite of the sailing of this squadron.
Oh, cried Jack, do you really think that could be so?
I have known the stratagem succeed. But it has to be used with great delicacy, lest the overreacher find himself overreached.
Well, I was certainly overreached, though I have a tolerable knowledge of the world, I believe. There are, no doubt, some uncommon deep old fires in Whitehall, and I'd better keep to navigation and the fiddle. Lord, laughing heartily, there I was, setting up for a political cove.
They paced for a while, and then he said,
I tell you what it is, Stephen. Ever since you told me about that good-natured, honest fellow Hinksey, music has been fairly bubbling up in me. Shall we play this evening?
Dr. Maturin had many of the virtues required in a medical man. He listened to what his patients had to say. He wished even the most repulsive of them well, once they had committed themselves to his care. He was indifferent to their fees, and with a great deal of reading and a great deal of experience, he was fully aware of the narrow limits of his powers, an awareness that on occasion he disguised, but only to keep their spirits up. He was a great believer in the healing powers of cheerfulness, if not of open mirth. Yet he had some faults, and one was a habit of dosing himself, generally from a spirit of inquiry, as in his period of inhaling large quantities of the nitrous oxide and of the vapour of hemp, to say nothing of tobacco. Bhang, in all its charming varieties in India, betel in Java and the neighbouring islands, khat in the Red Sea, and hallucinating cacti in South America, but sometimes for relief from distress, as when he became addicted to opium in one form or another, and now he was busily poisoning himself with coca leaves, whose virtue he had learnt in Peru. These he chewed with a little lime, carrying the leaves in a leather pouch, and the lime in a heart-shaped Peruvian silver box. But of late he had seemed to observe a diminution in their powers, possibly caused by long keeping. He did not appear to feel quite the same markedly anaesthetic effect in his mouth and pharynx. It might be no more than the result of long habituation, but he resolved that as soon as the squadron was within reach of Brazil, he would send over for a new supply. And this evening, since he wished to play particularly well, he took an unusually large dose. He did play well. They both played well.
and they thoroughly enjoyed their music. But whereas the Commodore, heavy with work, port, and toasted cheese, went straight to sleep the moment his head touched the pillow of his swinging cot, Stephen found the wakeful coca leaves as active as ever. They far outdid coffee in banishing even the thought of sleep. And as he wished to write up his notes in the morning, he took a powerful sleeping draught, together with a bolus of Java mandragore, and thrust balls of wax deep into his ears against the ship noises, the changing of the watch, the eventual holy stoning, scrubbing and swabbing of the decks, the screech and thump of the pumps. Long practice had made him proficient at this exercise, but he was in some ways a simple creature, and he had never perceived that on every succeeding Lady Day he was a year older, and that he was now exhibiting a vigorous young man's dose for a middle-aged body. It was often difficult to wake him in these circumstances. Today it was harder still.
"I beg pardon, sir," said Wilkins, the senior master's mate, to Harding, now the Bologna's first lieutenant, "but I can't wake him. I plucked off the clothes. He offered to bite and then curled up again, though we both hallooed in his ear and shook the cot."
It was Killick who brought him on deck at last, partly washed, partly clothed, but unshaven, stupid, sullen, blinking in what light there was.
"There you are, Doctor!" cried Jack, very loud. "Good morning to you! I hope you slept!"
"What's afoot?"
asked Stephen, peering heavily about. The squadron was hove to, and in their midst, with her topsails struck, lay a shabby merchantman bearing Spanish colours somewhat to the windward of the Bologna. As he looked, so the breeze wafted a sickening reek across the deck, and he was not surprised to hear Jack say,
"She is a slaver. Mr. Hewell knows the vessel, the Nancy, formerly belonging to Kingston, but lately sold. The master is coming aboard. I should like you to make out his nation, if you can, and look at his papers, if they are foreign. Lord, how I hope he is a wrong'un," he added in a private undertone.
Aboard the slaver, smoke was already pouring from the galley. Large numbers of black, naked women, girls, and children stood about the deck. The boat was slowly lowered down, and as the rim of the sun blazed above the horizon, the master came across with his papers and an interpreter.
"Do you speak English, sir?"
asked Captain Pullings.
"Very little, signor," said the master in a foreign accent. "Him interpret."
"You speak Spanish, however," said Stephen, in that language.
"Oh, si, si, signor," with an attempt at cheerful ease.
They exchanged a few sentences. Stephen held out his hand for the passport, and after a glance he tossed it overboard. The man uttered a howl and made as though to dive after it, but checked at the view of the populated sea.
"He is an impostor," said Stephen. "An Englishman. He knows no Spanish. His papers are false. You may safely seize the ship."
And to Jack,
"Let us go across."
Jack nodded and called to Hewell.
"There is nothing like the dawn for these discoveries," he said as they pulled over the water in his barge. "Time and again I have found a prize, and to leeward too, just before the first light."
But his voice changed entirely as they neared the slaver. The stench grew worse, the water still more filthy, and he fell abruptly silent at the sight of two small girls, grey and dead, going over the side. For a moment they were disputed by sharks hardly longer than themselves, until a huge fish, gliding from under the keel, tore them apart. The negroes did not understand what was happening. They had no notion of rescue, but only of some change of captivity, probably for the worse. They were frightened. At the same time they were desperate for their food and water. Hewell tried to reassure them in a variety of languages and the lingua franca of the coast. Apart from some of the small children, they did not believe him. The men had not been let out yet, but now the hatches were lifting, and the first group came staggering up the ladder, still writhed and bent, from their all-night crouch with headroom of 2 feet 6 inches at the best. Jack, Stephen, Hewell, and Bondon went down into the unbreathable fetter, watched nervously by the slaver's hands, who held their whips in an uncertain, awkward fashion. The slaves farthest aft came out, scarcely looking at them, rubbing knees and elbows and galled heads. They were chained in pairs. Their expressions upon the whole were inhuman, apathy with underlying dread, but no evident single emotion. The files seemed endless, scores and scores of bowed, thin, wretched men, naked and a lightless black. But in time it thinned and almost stopped. Hewell said,
"Now we have reached this sick, no doubt. They are always stowed forward, where there is a little air through the hawse holes. Perhaps you would like to come and see, Doctor."
Stephen, who had known some shocking prison infirmaries, lunatic asylums and poorhouse wards, had a professional armour. So, from his voyages in a slaver, had Huel. Jack had none. The gun deck amidships in a hard-fought fleet action, the slaughterhouse, as it was called, had in no way prepared him for this, and his head swam. He walked forward doggedly after them, bowed under the low beams. He heard Stephen give orders for the removal of the irons, saw him examine several men too weak to move in the dim light and stifling air, understood him to say that there was dysentery here, that hands were needed, water and swabs. He reached the deck. The slaver's men looked at him in dismay, and in a strangled, savage, barking voice he ordered 6 below with buckets and swabs, 6 to the pumps, and 4 to look alive there in the galley, all whips overboard. Some of the slaves looked at him, but without much curiosity. Some were already washing. Most sat there on the deck, still bowed.
"Bellona!" he hailed.
"Sir?"
"Send that fellow over with his men, a file of marines and an officer. The armourer and his mate, the surgeon's assistants."
He called for the ship's steward, told him to spread all the cabin bedding out on deck, and as the sick came up, supported or carried, he had them laid upon it. The Nancy's master came aboard.
"Take this swab," said Jack, bending over his appalled face as he climbed the side. "Take this swab and clean up below. Clean up below. Clean up below."
There was never at any time the least question of disobedience in the slaver. On the contrary, all hands showed an obscurely disgusting zeal. And now, as the marines took up their station, a double rank right aft, with their muskets at their sides, food was coming from the galley in mess kits for 10, and the slaves formed their habitual groups, almost filling the deck. 500 at the least.
"Mr. Huel," said Jack, "could you tell them that they are not to be harmed, nor to be sold, but to be set free when we reach Sierra Leone in a couple of days?"
"I shall try, sir, with what smattering I possess."
This he did, loud and clear, in several versions. Half a dozen black men showed some interest, some comprehension. The rest ate wolfishly, their eyes fixed on vacancy or on a world that had no meaning.
"Mr. Huel," said Jack again, "are you of opinion that it would be safe to knock off their irons?"
"Yes, sir, so long as the marines are here. But I believe the hands should be taken off before nightfall, and a strong prize crew, well armed, would prevent any trouble in the darkness."
Jack nodded.
"If there is anything the doctor needs, boats, hammocks, stretchers or the like," for Stephen had set up a sick berth in the ravaged cabin, "let Captain Pullings know at once. You will be relieved before the end of the watch, Davies,"
he said to one of the bargemen, a big, ugly, violent seaman who had followed him from ship to ship.
"You see that those fellows at the pumps and down below are kept busy. You may start them if they are slack in stays."
He returned to the Bellona, took off all his clothes, stood long under a jet of clear water, retired to his cabin and there sat considering, revolving the possibilities open to him, thinking closely, taking notes, and writing 2 letters to Captain Wood at Sierra Leone, the one official, the other private. During this time, or part of it, Stephen sat with Huel on the slaver's capstan, the wind being abaft her quarter, and the air clean as the squadron stood southeast. He was reasonably satisfied with his patience. He had put salve and clean linen on many and many an iron-chafed wrist, and there was a somewhat more human feeling on the well-fed deck.
"From your experience, would you say that this vessel was in a very bad condition?" he asked.
"Oh, no, not at all," said Huel. "For a ship 14 days out of Whydah, I should say she was doing rather well. No, it is ugly, of course, and I believe the Commodore was sadly shocked, but there was little dysentery, and that in an early stage, and it can be far, far worse. Perhaps the ugliest I ever saw was a brig called the Gongora that we chased for 3 days off the coast. All that time the slaves were, of course, kept below. No food, precious little air with her running before the wind, and when at last we took her and opened the hatches, there were 200 dead below. Dysentery, starvation, suffocation, misery, and above all fighting before they grew too weak to beat one another to death with their irons. The wretched brig carried almost equal numbers of Fantis and Ashantis, mortal enemies who had been at war, each side selling its prisoners in the same market, and they crammed in together."
"Oh, beg pardon, sir," said a tall master's mate, rising up the side, "but I'm come to relieve Mr. Huel. The Commodore wishes to see him when he has washed and changed."
"Mr. Huel," said Jack,
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it is the rule of Sierra Leone to saw captured and condemned slavers in half, with an estimated auction price being distributed as prize money.
Yes, sir. Formerly the really fast craft were simply bought by the merchants and used again in the trade.
Very well. You have also told the doctor and me about the crewmen, described as capital seamen, pilots for various stretches of the coast, intelligent and reliable.
Yes, sir. They have always had that reputation, and I have found them to deserve it through and through. I have had a great deal to do with them, ever since I was a boy, and what is more, most of them speak Coast English well and understand it even better.
I am glad to hear it. Now here are two letters for Captain Wood, the Governor. I ask him to have this ship, this Nancy, condemned at once, out of hand, and for her to be moored in the roads once she is empty, and I ask him to have a powder hoy, a loaded powder hoy, ready for me when the squadron arrives. If he will do these things, and I have little or no doubt of it, I desire you to use your best endeavours to recruit at least one good crewman for each of the squadron's boats from the 6-oared cutter up, in order to guide them by night to raid Sherbrooke Island and perhaps the Gallinas River. Do you think this feasible, Mr. Hewell?
With this steady leading breeze, perfectly feasible, sir, and I have no fear for the crewmen. There is a crew town in Sierra Leone with some hundreds of them, men I have known these 25 years, and they hate slavery. We'll have nothing to do with it.
I'm very happy to hear you say so. Mr. Adams will give you your order and whatever money you judge necessary for the crewmen. You will go aboard the Ringle as soon as possible and proceed to Sierra Leone without the loss of a minute. Take Mr. Reed with you. He handles her beautifully. And you may carry a press of sail, Mr. Hewell. Good day to you.